I didn't feel satisfied. So I'd eat this pie and then I'd sneak into the kitchen and get some chocolate because it wasn't enough. And so that was the part that I'd feel guilt about. I'd be like, why do I want more? Like, I just ate a massive pie and ice cream. Like, why do I need more? But I just couldn't help myself. It just wasn't enough.
Welcome to the Eat for Endurance podcast. My name is Claire Shorenstein, and I'm a registered dietitian and running coach based in New York City. My goal for this podcast, aside from having fun, of course, is to demonstrate that there is no one-size-fits-all style of eating. Rather, there are many different pathways towards individualized health and sports performance. I explore this in my athlete nutrition profiles, as well as in interviews with fellow dietitians on their areas of expertise. This week's nutrition profile features Tina Muir, an elite runner for Great Britain and Northern Ireland, host of the Running for Real podcast, and a soon-to-be mom of two. She famously stopped running in 2017 at the peak of her career and just a few months after setting a PR of 2:36 in the marathon when she decided to prioritize her health and well-being after not having had her period for 9 years. She has openly shared her story to bring more awareness to amenorrhea and eating issues commonly found among female athletes and has created a wonderful online community for runners to support one another on good days and bad. I really enjoyed learning about Tina's nutrition background and how her approach to nutrition has evolved over time, and I hope you enjoy our discussion as well. But before we dive in, can I ask a quick favor? This podcast is currently free and not sponsored, so if you are enjoying these episodes and have a moment to show your support by leaving a rating or review on iTunes and sharing it with friends, I'd really appreciate it. I'd love to keep the podcast going, and of course, more listeners will help with that. All right, enjoy my chat with Tina Muir. Hey, Tina, welcome to the Eat for Endurance podcast. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk to you.
Awesome. So before we chat about running, I always start these podcasts by exploring your nutrition roots. And you, of course, have a little bit of a different background because you are British and you're from, is it St. Albans, right? Mm-hmm. Outside of London. But you spent quite a few of your childhood years in the U.S. So, yeah, why don't you tell me a little bit about what food looked like for you growing up and kind of where you were at. I know you're currently in St. Louis, is that right? Or you were Kentucky yep. before. You've been kind of all around. Yeah, so mm-hmm. why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so, I mean, like Britain to America, I wouldn't say it's a massive difference. I mean, it's generally a Western country, so we, you know, have the same kind of, you know, when diets come through, they generally roll through the same countries, but or through both countries. But the biggest difference, I would say, in England, it's a lot more over here. It's kind of all about like these big meals, and there's a lot more like sugar in everything. Mm-hmm. But in England, I'd say there's a lot more sweet things. So people tend to like growing up, I would have what we call biscuits, kind of maybe like a shortbread over here, or like a kind of like a graham cracker, I guess, you'd have something similar to that every few hours. And that was just, people would have it with a cup of tea. I wasn't a tea drinker, but that's what people would have. Whereas over here, I felt like it was a lot more kind of, you go out for these big indulgent ice creams, or you go out, like in England, you might go for a meal and it would be a 3-course meal and you could have a starter, a main and a dessert because the meals weren't huge and you could handle that. And also going out to eat over there was a lot more of a rare thing. It was kind of a celebration. Whereas here, my husband and I probably go out to eat once a week. And I feel like we are in the absolute minority with that, because I feel like most people eat out all the time, and all the meals are big. So you either tend to eat half of it and then take it home, or you eat the whole thing, but just the meal rather than the starter and dessert. And so in England, there is no, in most places, there is no take home. You eat what you eat there and that's it. So there were some differences I saw. But for the most part, my dad and sister and my mum, to an extent, had always kind of ingrained in me that when we go out to eat, it's a special occasion. You make the most of it. You get whatever you want. Especially my dad has always kind of been, he's the kind of person that if he went to a restaurant and there was a burger with onion rings and pulled pork, he would have it. If that sounded good to him, he would have it. My mum had anorexia before she had me. So she would do the same, get what she wanted, but she also was a little bit more careful about her food choices, just in general life, day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, yeah, I was kind of happy to grow up in this lifestyle where I didn't really feel like I had to kind of watch things too much. I feel like looking at, I don't know if it's just the times have changed as well, but looking at over here in the US, I still feel like things are very different in that there's a lot more talk of diet. There's a lot more like awareness and kind of extremes. Whereas I feel like in England, most people kind of sit in the middle. I mean, there obviously is obesity in England. And I would say in general, people have a bit more of a beer belly in England. It tends to sit around their middle. But whether it's a beer belly or a food belly, I'm not sure. But overall, I would say people are a little bit healthier. So that helped me. But coming over here, you know, I had periods of being over here. And the first year I spent over here as a teenager, I gained a lot of weight. And I think that was just having all this indulgent food all the time, going out to eat all the time. Panda Express orange chicken was definitely a favorite. Now I couldn't imagine.
Champion was mine.
Yeah. So I kind of bounced around, but still had a lot of my ideals. But within the running world, I definitely, growing up, saw a lot of cases of people not eating very much and being very thin. So that was also there as well.
Yeah. And how did your mom having anorexia, and I mean, I'm not sure if your mom cooked or your dad cooked or who cooked in the house, but did that kind of leave an impression on you in any way when you were younger? Because you also were in the US when you were very young, right?
Yeah, yeah. I also should add, one of my aunts has been anorexic 40 years as well, still is. My mom is of normal weight. You very much wouldn't know her past unless you spent a lot of time with her. Looking back, there are some things I think I've seen. Little habits like I mentioned that my mum would eat wherever she wanted when she got out for a meal, when we'd go out for a meal. But then there was also if she knew she'd eaten a lot that night, she would, you know, definitely eat less the day after, which I maybe did pick up some of those habits myself, kind of saving myself essentially for meals. Mm-hmm. But I think that was, you know, that's not a rare thing. I think a lot of people tend to do that. So I didn't see that as something big, but no, I mean, my dad was the one that cooked. My dad loves to cook as much as he pretends he doesn't. I know he enjoys it. and so I think that helped in a lot of ways because it removed the control from my mum. So she just kind of ate what was put in front of her. My dad is very good at kind of dinner times, making it a well-balanced meal without it being just like plain chicken and vegetables. He definitely makes it balanced, but he makes it taste good as well. So yeah, I think my dad cooking was a big part of keeping the habits healthy. And again, my sister and I both kind of picked up on his habits in a lot of ways, in that we just kind of ate as we wanted, what we wanted, when we wanted. And then as for when I was in America, I was 2 to 5. So I don't really remember too much. But looking back on photos, my dad was pretty slim. So, I mean, he must have been able to find a balance somehow, or maybe his metabolism was still, he was just young enough to where it was still burning pretty fast that he could get away with it. I'm not really sure.
Yeah. Now, you were, of course, you know, later on an elite runner for Great Britain and Northern Ireland. You were living in the UK at that point, or where, I'm assuming you were, like, were you in St. Albans, Bexley Albans? Were you in London? Like, where were you at that point?
No, I didn't do that. I didn't hit that goal until I was 28. So I'd been here in the US for a long time at that point.
Okay. All right. Got it. And let's kind of visit how you got into running a bit. We don't have to go into the whole story about how you started running, but I've kind of read that you weren't really a lover of running, you know, like from the start at least. And I think I heard on another podcast, you were like hiding in the bleachers or something like that.
Yeah.
But how did you grow to love running? Like how did, you know, I don't know if you're involved in other sports, you loved other sports, or, you know, if seeing yourself as a professional runner later in life was just something you never really envisioned. But yeah, how did that kind of happen for you?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't a massive fan of running at the beginning. yeah, I did. I hid in the toilets during the tryouts. That's kind of the story I tell. But okay. I think a lot of it probably was more social, that it wasn't cool to like running, particularly in England. I think over here in the US, if you're on the cross country team, you kind of have this group that you like stick with, and you got a friendship group. Whereas in England, there was no running group. There was like, there were running training clubs, but for my age, there wasn't really much. So I wonder now how much of it was I didn't even give it a chance, because everyone said how uncool it was and how much they hated it. that I just kind of, you know, I was just trying to fit in. But as I've told before, somehow I found myself at the front and ended up on the cross country team. I don't remember how that happened, but I did. And I also did field hockey, which I really enjoyed. But I learned very early on that I wasn't particularly great at field hockey itself. I just could kind of outrun everyone. And outlast people. I also played tennis. I really enjoyed that. So I did have other sports in my life, but I'd not materialistic, but as kind of predictable as it is, being a 14, 15 year old, the time I started to enjoy it was when I started to do well. You know, as I made my way up, as I climbed up the rankings, within the national rankings, that's when I kind of started to say that I enjoyed it. A lot of it was that, you know, you like what you're good at. And
sure.
So the hockey pointed towards that. And then when I ended up on the cross country team, that was kind of more of that. And then, you know, when you get celebrated within your own school, that brings on more of that. And yeah, I think it just kind of went from there. But I wouldn't have seen myself as a professional runner. However, in England, this over in the US, the schooling system is that most people who are good at running as teenagers go to university. It's an incredibly intense period. Your life is your sport, but then a lot of people kind of get to the end of that and then they're done. And a lot of that is burnout. A lot of that is just lack of opportunities. But in England, there's not as much focus on the university level, but people tend to keep going for life. If you make it past that 18, 19 transition period from high school to university and you keep going, you're going to keep going for life. So I hadn't really considered a life without running in my mind, because I had grown up around that environment. So for me, it wasn't so much a conscious decision to, I'm going to become a professional, I'm going to do this, you know, for a living. It was more, well, that's just what you do. Why would you give it up now? So, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm actually surprised about the whole uncool running part. I mean, maybe it is really just that age group, because I actually lived in London for 4 years. My husband lived there for 11 years, is where we met. And that's actually where I got into marathoning and like distance running. And the running culture was just so vibrant there, you know, and there were so many.
It has changed a lot. Definitely.
Yeah. So I mean, that was more recent, obviously. And of course, that was when I was in my, I guess, late 20s as well. Yeah. But it was just such, you know, everyone run commutes, there's showers in the office. Yeah. Like, it's just such this thing that everyone does, which was pretty awesome. All right. And so as you became more competitive and you know, you were more recognized, as you were saying, did you notice any changes in your eating habits, in your nutrition? Were you thinking about sports nutrition at all? Or were you just kind of continuing to do what you were doing?
There was a few major points in my life that kind of stand out to me. One being, I remember driving to the national championships, being a teenager, maybe 16, 17, sitting next to a girl who ended up either winning or being right at the top. And she didn't really eat anything. When I was eating my pre-race meal, she just kind of like picked at things, you know, and you see people like have a bar and they like take tiny little pieces off.
Yeah.
I remember thinking like, how does she run like that when she doesn't eat? And I just, to me, it like blew my mind. I just was like, how, like, I kind of almost saw it a bit too simply, that kind of almost as if like food was like charging a battery. And like, if she didn't eat, then how were her batteries not like dead? And so I really just couldn't understand that. But, you know, I obviously banked it because I still remember it to this day. She ended up doing really well for a year or two. And then I don't think she runs now, completely disappeared. And then I remember being in college and hearing, this is the story I've told a lot. I overheard one of the coaches telling another girl she needed to lose 10 pounds and thinking, well, she doesn't look that bit like, I don't understand that. Like, why does she need to lose weight? So then I asked him, should I lose weight? And he said, yes. Funny story. I haven't actually told anyone this. I saw him a few months ago in the airport.
Oh,
for the first time. He actually left at the end of that year. And I saw him a few months ago at the airport. And I did the pleasantries of, hi, how are you, blah, blah, blah. But then afterwards, I was like, God, I wish I said something. Like, do you realize what you did to my life? But I didn't.
Oh,
I was
man. Chicken.
Although, in the grand scheme of things, things happen for a reason. But it was funny seeing him in the airport being like, but yeah, that came. And then he said, yeah, can lose a few pounds. That definitely sent me down a trajectory where I thought I needed to lose weight to be better. It wasn't at that time aesthetic. Looking back at photos, I was definitely, I wasn't overweight in any way, but I was a little bit puffy. I think it was more kind of, and I don't mean puffy as in like chubby. I mean, just kind of, I'd been drinking a lot the year before. I've been eating Panda Express. I think it was more just kind of like a bloating all the salt and all the alcohol in my body. So I don't think it was anything that, but I didn't see anything wrong with the way I looked. Although I had had someone, I'd overheard someone saying he thought I was too big to run fast. And that had kind of stayed in my mind. So I had all these little things that kind of added up, but that coach saying that was the kind of kicker that made me do it for performance and think I need to get faster. I need to eat less. One of the downsides of being on a college team, and there's thankfully a lot of awareness and conversation going on about this, but girls' college teams are a very, very dangerous place. It was very easy to get into like a competition with the other girls on the team about like trying to eat the healthiest, but then wanting to, you know, not show that you were eating nothing, you were doing it, I don't know, like you weren't insecure about your weight, all this kind of drama underneath. And I just kind of found myself getting lower and lower. And then once I moved into the elite world, it was very much just a comparison game. Then I did start looking around me and seeing other women who were a lot thinner than I was, although looking back now, they weren't that much thinner than me. But time they seemed to have these six packs and these just toned lean bodies, and I thought I didn't have that. So then it became a conscious decision more for aesthetics than I would say performance.
It's so hard, and you know, whether you're overhearing something that someone says about you, whether someone's saying it directly to your face about it, it's I mean, those aren't little things. I mean, those are deeply influential things for you, as you know, you express. So and thankfully we're seeing change around that now, you know, with people speaking up about you know, with Mary Kane and all that kind of stuff coming out about how coaches are handling especially young impressionable female athletes. So it's an important thing to talk about. Yeah, of course.
One more thing with that. I mean, that's why I spend so much of my time trying to, I think it's one thing for people in the media, people like myself, people who are, you know, maybe bigger influencers to say something. But as you said, those aren't little things. And I think so much of what I'm trying to do is to make every woman, every man realize that we all have young girls in particular and young boys, but young girls in our lives that are influenced by us. And like you said, it could be you overhearing. It could be you walking through Target, a little girl, your daughter, your niece, your a friend, family friend, walking through Target, hearing two women who she sees as perfect Barbie dolls saying, my butt looks big, or whatever it may be. And that makes an impression. So like, I mean, I'm sure your audience already knows this, but I want to get across the message that it's not just the people in the media. It's not just the you know, the spotlight people. It's every, we all need to change the way that we talk about ourselves in front of any child, because you never know who's listening. So
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's not just athletes. It's any person. And I'm sure you are, you know, extra aware raising a young daughter, you know, young girl. And I will be raising two young girls. And I think it's safe to say that most women have some degree of disordered eating. You know, it's so normalized at this point. I don't think anyone has a simple relationship with food. I mean, maybe some people, it's very kind. I have the occasional client where it's just like, just tell me what to eat, I'll eat it, like it's no big deal, you know. But most people have these like very complex very complex history with food, and also a history of family members, friends, loved ones, whoever, ex-boyfriends, husbands, wives, you know, like commenting on their bodies. Mm-hmm. You know, and so, yes, when you are an athlete and it has to do with performance, there's that aspect. But it doesn't mean like just because you're not an athlete doesn't mean you're immune to all this stuff. Like it's happening within everybody. Exactly. And so I know for me, like I remember, reading through Seventeen magazine. I don't know if you ever read that growing up in the States, but I remember reading Seventeen magazine and it was an article about eating disorders and, basically being like, don't do this. And I was like, ooh, that's a good idea. I should do that. You know, like I should try not eating until like how I almost would have a competition with myself. This was in high school. And I was like on cross country or whatever, but not, I wasn't very competitive. I was just kind of running for fun, but I'd be like, ooh, I wonder how long I can go without eating today. And like by 1 PM, I'm like, cool, I made it to 1 PM. And I literally got that from an article telling me not to be anorexic and bulimic. And it's, or like, yeah, someone commenting on something, or it's just nuts. And as you say, like, you know, whether it's a school team, or, you know, especially those highly competitive collegiate teams, like, yeah, those are tough places. And thankfully, I think, again, things are starting to change. I think it's more common for teams to have like a dietitian on hand to help.
Yeah.
At least from what I've, you know, when I'm doing these athlete nutrition profiles and kind of people in our age group, it seems, back then it was a little less common to have that. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that's kind of helping as well. I 100% agree with what you said. So I'm glad you said that. So you graduated from college, that period in your 20s, you said you kind of turned pro and it was in your like late 20s. It was that you started your professional career. Like, so what was going on in that time then, before you started running professionally?
Yeah. I mean, as I said, like, running professionally, there's no, like in the running world, it's really confusing because there isn't, you know, there's no like triathlon where you get your pro card and,
sure.
You know, with running, it's just kind of, I mean, I don't know where I would consider myself professional or not. I was winning some money at races. Was it enough to live off? No way. Was I being paid by my sponsor? No. I just had shoes and clothes. So, I don't know, like, how, for me, I was just kind of running at the elite level. I was running at high levels. I didn't really see it as such. But I did come out of college, decided I really enjoyed doing all the longer stuff in college. And I built myself up to a 17-mile long run, and I think maybe even 18 or 19 at one point. And I loved it. Like, I loved those long runs. And so the marathon was kind of a natural progression. So we did a few half marathons and then I moved up to the marathon. But it wasn't a natural progression to the marathon in that I didn't take it like a fish to water, or like we just saw Molly Seidel doing her first marathon.
Oh my,
it wasn't
goodness,
anything like that.
That was amazing.
Yeah. I tanked my first one. Second one wasn't very good. I mean, obviously to your listeners, this is relative.
Yes.
But not indicative of what I kind of had hints of doing. But I, you know, knew there was promise there. We knew there was potential. And I still don't think I ever hit my potential or even close to it within the marathon. But I, you know, was giving it my all. I was committing my life to it. My husband had a job that thankfully was allowed him to help me as much as he could to be my coach, but also to be there for me for key workouts and things like that. So yeah, I was very fortunate with that aspect. And then with the a nutrition thing, as I kind of moved towards where I wanted to be, you know, that very top level, I started getting curious about my lack of period at that point.
Yes.
And making changes within my nutrition, because I'd read, you know, you're not eating enough fats. So I tried to eat more fats. But then eating more fats led me down I'm going to eat more fats and protein. And then that kind of pushed the carbs out. And then I kind of got into clean eating. And because, you know, when you're eating more fats and more proteins, clean eating, very like, not quite keto, but heading that way is almost.
What does that even mean? And, you know, like whenever someone says clean eating, it's like, what does that even mean to you? And it means something, it's just like such a it means something different to everybody, right?
I mean, to me, it was just like very pure foods. Like I was eating like, yeah, I'd put, you know, I'd cook my sweet potatoes in oil and butter or whatever. But I would ask for my salad dressing on the side, or I would, be very, purist with what my food was, very judgmental of any food that was processed. Like the idea, like pizza, I would eat pizza, but I'd be like, oh, you know, that's not good because it's just all processed. So for me, that's kind of where it ended up going. But yeah, I understand what you're saying. It is a bit of a, I don't know, it's just a word thrown around in the health food industry. But yeah, for me, it was kind of an obsession getting towards orthorexia, an obsession with healthy eating. Although that being said, as I'm sure you're asking in a minute, I still, sugar wise, I would get to the evening and I just could not stop myself. I was eating sweets throughout the day constantly. Every hour or two, I'd need a few Twizzlers or, something sugary, something sweet, and not strawberries or cherries, but like it had to be something processed, exactly what I was going against everything else. But the evenings, I had to have like four servings of ice cream or a brownie and ice cream or something massive. And now I obviously know why that was.
Yes.
But at the time I was like, I just have a sweet tooth.
Would you beat yourself up about it afterwards? Would you feel guilty, or would it just be like, oh, I'm running a ton, it's fine? Or what were the thoughts surrounding that?
Sometimes I would. But for the most part, I knew that I knew deep down that I hadn't I'd eaten little enough in the, and it wasn't that I was barely eating. I was eating what I would consider a normal amount of food for a normal person. Just not like, not for what I was doing.
Yeah, you're running 90 miles a week, you said it.
Yeah. I was eating more than, exactly. I was eating more than, you know, if you put me next to a friend who didn't run, I was eating way more than they were. But I was also, like you said, running an average of 12 miles a day. So the sweets, I did feel like I'd earned them. However, the thing I felt a lot of guilt about is sometimes I would eat this massive, like, I don't know, like sometimes let's say I would eat a slice of pie with ice cream, very calorically dense, very sugary. But I didn't feel satisfied. So I'd eat this pie and then I'd sneak into the kitchen and get some chocolate because it wasn't enough. And so that was the part that I'd feel guilt about. I'd be like, why do I want more? Like I just ate a massive pie and ice cream. Like, why do I need more? But I just couldn't help myself. It just wasn't enough. Or I'd had a cupcake, one of those big cupcakes with loads of frosting. Mm-hmm. But then I'd sneak into the kitchen and grab another scoop of frosting, just a scoop of frosting, nothing else. But like, so that was more of what I felt guilt over. But the desserts themselves, no, I kind of felt like that was my reward.
Yeah. And when you say sneak into the kitchen, was that sneaking past your husband? Was that like, what was that? What was the sneaking?
Yeah,
were you hiding it from somebody?
Yeah, I would say I was probably hiding it. I mean, if he caught me, I wouldn't be like, you know, like terrified, but I was kind of embarrassed that it wasn't, you know, like he would just laugh if he caught me doing it. It wasn't like I was hiding in a corner, but he probably knew what I was doing. I'd get up and go into the kitchen afterwards. And I wouldn't try and hide it or get defensive if he saw me, but I still definitely felt embarrassed about it.
Yeah. And I mean, you said, you know, why now? Well, yeah, as you know, you've spoken about before, like your body just wasn't getting enough. And that's how it manifested, right? Which is very common. Now, your husband as your coach, was he kind of your coach this entire time? And did that influence your food decisions at all? Like, what's that dynamic like?
Yeah. Yeah, he's been my coach since I was like 20. And I was that entire time. But unfortunately, he's one of those like food is fuel people. Like I could spend 4 hours making a really nice meal and he'll be like, yes, good. And then I could, you know, throw together something in 5 minutes. Yes, good. Like he's just food is fuel. So for him, he's never really understood my relationship with food, because for him, he just didn't get it. He just thought, well, you know, it's not about emotions. It's your food. So he very much like he eats what he wants. Like, you know, if he loves chocolate chip cookies, if I make chocolate chip cookies, he will eat half the batch within a night, but he doesn't care. Or if we go out to eat, he'll get that meal that I mentioned that my dad gets if he wants it. So he never really had like a negative impact on me. And, you know, because of what I'd been ingrained as a child, I would, when we went out to eat, we would kind of go for it. We would kind of make the most of it. But because he was at work all day, I think he didn't see a lot of the restriction that I was doing during those times. So I don't think he really kind of put it together. And we didn't have the education to know what was going on. I did speak to quote unquote nutritionists, multiple people, and they all said, well, you seem to be eating enough to me, so I don't think that's the problem. So both of us were a bit confused because we were like, oh, it must be something else wrong with you, or not wrong with you, but something else going on there. So he was aware
of everything. You mean with regards to the lack of the period, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah. He was aware of everything, but he just didn't really have anything to add. So we kind of just let it be.
Yeah. So let's talk about amenorrhea or the cessation of period now, because that's, you know, one of the things you famously quit running very suddenly at the peak of your career. You know, you were in all these different news articles and all this stuff. This was back in 2017, as you were saying, going from 90 miles to zero per week. And that was in part because you wanted to try to commit to getting your period back after trying the nutrition, trying other things, which wasn't working. But also because you were kind of, I guess it seems, burnt out. You hadn't lost your running mojo. And even I read the recent, you were just recently signed on by Ultra, which is amazing, pregnant, which is like absolutely incredible. I love it. And even the press release, it was, you know, called medical malnutrition, right? So, let's talk a little bit about this, because this is one of the things that you're really, really determined to kind of spread the word and talk to people about, normalize. And mostly for women, but also for men, too, about underfueling and the effects of that. Right. We talked already a little bit about how you feel like you got there, a little bit about what you tried. Let's just talk a little bit about that, how it plays into, for instance, how I think at the time you had said like you were scared to share it because it was so tied to eating disorders. And at that time you really didn't feel like you had one. And, you know, of course here you are eating pie and ice cream and all this stuff. So how could you possibly have an eating disorder? But those are just, again, manifestations of your restriction. Why don't you share a little bit about that? How that experience also of coming to the realization that you did in fact probably have an eating disorder at that time. Talk to us a little bit about that whole thing.
Well, firstly, the medical malnutrition, I'm sure you've heard of, or many of your listeners have heard of, Dr. Jennifer Gaudiani. When I was speaking to her last year, I said, you know, what am I supposed to call this? Like, I don't really, like, do I say, like, you know, there's no real phrase for me. And she said, oh, it's medical malnutrition. And I thought, you know, actually, that's really good. Like, I've adopted that from her, but I have to give her the credit for giving me that, putting that in my ear. And yeah, as I have mentioned, she was the one that made me finally accept it and realize, because as you mentioned, I, you know, had all these things going on, it was there. And I'm sure many dietitians who I know were looking at me and being like, oh, you're just not seeing it. You're just, they couldn't tell me, but they just kind of were like shaking their heads at me. But she, you know, last year when I was talking to her about something, she said to me, when did you start working on your recovery from your eating disorder? And I said, I don't have an eating disorder. I didn't have one. And she said, I think she said like, sweetie, you did. And I was like, huh? Like she said something like that. And I was like, I didn't. But then after talking to her, you know, she said, just because you recovered doesn't mean, or just because you kind of made drastic changes doesn't mean it was never there. So then that allowed me to kind of finally open up that vault of myself and say, yeah, I probably did. And I can see it now. The primary thing being the restriction. As I mentioned, like if I knew I was going out to eat, I'd be like, okay, well, you're going to eat an apple, some sweet potatoes, some roasted sweet potatoes, some hummus and carrots for lunch. And, you know, okay, all right, I'm hungry again. It's an hour later. All right, well, you can have some celery with peanut butter. And then I'm hungry another, you know, 2 hours later. And I'm like, all right, well, let's have another apple. And then I'm hungry at 5. All right, well, you got an hour to wait. You can hang on an hour. Things like that. I can see it. But at the time, I just couldn't. And I think, I'm sorry, I've completely lost where I was going with that. The question was about
amenorrhea and kind of the whole, you know, coming out with that and the eating disorder part.
I had the amenorrhea part. As I mentioned earlier, I tried to change things in my diet that wasn't helping. And so I was getting more and more frustrated with that and the burnout of the running, the having accomplished that massive goal of mine was leaving me feeling a bit deflated. I didn't know what to set up next. I wasn't motivated by anything I'd chosen. And so a lot of it was kind of just a combination of factors. My sister had a baby. I'd never really been around a newborn, and I got to see, you know, this magic of life. And my sister and I are close. So, that was very impactful for me. But, also seeing other signs. I always said I had Raynaud's because my fingers and toes would get so cold all the time. And be so painful. Like I remember many times where it like almost brought me to tears. Like it's making me clench my fists thinking about it. Like it's so painful on my fingers. But I'd always, my grandma had Raynaud's and my aunt who, the one who has anorexia, has Raynaud's. And obviously it's not just Raynaud's in her case. But so I'd always just been like, oh, I have Raynaud's. And you know, that was something. Or I'd get like a stomach upset really easily. That was another huge warning sign. The blood test kept coming back as everything was fine except for the female hormones. And so there were so many signs that kind of were screaming at me to be paid attention to, but I just, moodiness as well, like, very snappy. Insomnia was a big one for me. I would, my eyes would ping open at 4 a.m., it didn't matter if I'd gone to bed at 11 and I'd done a 25-mile run that day. At 4 a.m., my eyes would ping open. And now I know I was hungry and I wanted to get up and eat. And, my body couldn't sleep. So I had all these signs. I hid behind the sugar. I said, if I had an eating disorder, I wouldn't be able to eat this. And I've gone back and forth on whether had I not had a sweet tooth, or had my mum and my family, like a lot of my family have sweet tooths, like they're very into sugar. My dad and sister, not so much, but everyone else in my family has a sweet tooth. And so had I not had that to fall back on, I've always said that my sweet tooth saved me. I don't know if it did, because maybe then had I not had that sweet tooth, I would have been able to kind of give myself a more realistic assessment, whereas I could always fall back on the sugar. I always knew I could get calories through sugar. And so I don't know if I'm answering your question here, but I wanted to speak
out because
I'd spoken to so many other women who were also saying that they didn't have their period and they didn't understand what was wrong with them. And I'd always felt broken and embarrassed that you know, I couldn't do something that was so normal. Like, it was just the thing that a woman had every month. So I felt embarrassed. I'd heard older family friends saying I looked like a teenage boy in my shape of my body. So I knew that was obviously a sign of things not working the way they should be. And so I think I just kind of reached a point where if I was going to do this, I wanted to go big and scream it to really help as many people as I could.
Yeah. And I mean, it takes a lot of courage to like come out and talk about the fact that you haven't had your period in 9 years when it's still not a talked about thing, but also, you know, having just run a PR, you had just run, it was in, I think, CIM or where was it? You had just run a PR.
Yeah. I'd run my PR like, I mean, 2-3 months before I stopped running.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not like you weren't doing great. You know, it's not like you were suffering and clearly things were wrong. You're trying to figure it out. It's like you had just run at a great time and you prioritized your health, which is really admirable and inspiring, you know, because that's what we should be doing, you know, even though, you know, in a time where everyone's trying to do anything they can to get an edge, it's really important to obviously look after you. So, mm-hmm. So that was very inspiring to see you do that.
Thank you.
And so you stopped completely and you tried to regain weight, you know, and you just so completely stopped running, regaining weight and got pregnant within 10 weeks, which is another huge transition. So I can only imagine what that must have been like going through all that. You know, I imagine it was really hard just going from this period of being very restricted from, even though like you weren't, like you were burnt out from running, still you're going from being extremely active to not active at all. And that's a, you know, mentally and physically a hard transition. And you're eating all these things that you were previously restricting. What was that like for you? And I think you were working with a dietitian at this time too, as well, on intuitive eating. Is that correct?
Or
was later? Kind of, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it was probably about halfway through. I hate saying this because I remember when I did come out saying I was pregnant, seeing some not aggressive comments towards me, but like kind of a bit like, oh, well, of course it happened for you, like that kind of comments of, and I understand that part of that is, you know, my family must be very fertile. My sister and I both got pregnant the first month we tried. My grandma had 10 children. So, you know, I do have genetics on my side there. I didn't have as much trouble with the mental side of things as people would think, and as other women do. Most women who speak to me and have reached out to me are really struggling with that transition. And I give them so much credit because that is the hardest part. And I have so many women reach out and say, you know, I've gained the weight, I'm doing it. I don't know, am I ever going to get back to running? Am I ever going to find myself? And I didn't have that so much. So I always, you know, say to them, like, you've got to, like, I understand you're doing the eating part. I understand you're changing your diet, but you've got to help yourself with the mental aspect because, I don't have the advice there. I can give what I can, but for me, a lot of it was, you mentioned the burnout. I was so burned out on running that it was kind of, you know how, like when you're, when you've been in a really hot car and it's really cold outside, but you get outside and you're just like, any other time you'd be like, oh, I don't want to get out in that cold, but it just feels good. That's kind of how it felt with me with this, that it's stopping doing it on my own terms, not an injury taking me out. Or like you said, going out because I wasn't doing well. That was so empowering to me. I journaled a lot, which helped me kind of process my thoughts. And I channeled my competitiveness into, I was going to do this as quick as I could. But at the same time, I don't know how, because it's kind of against my personality. I somehow had this kind of relaxed approach of it'll happen when it'll happen. I'm learning who I am. I'm finding myself. So I kind of had a peace with it. And so, yeah, as much as it really frustrates people for me to say it, I really didn't actually struggle too much with the transition. And then when I got pregnant, I had a whole new thing. It was not about me anymore. I knew I had a child growing and I was going to give them the best chance that I could. And then when I found out it was a girl, I think that's when the change happened for me, because I thought, wow, like whatever, like I'd done the kind of self-reflection and whatever insecurities I had within myself, whatever like things that I wasn't saying that were still inside of me, I was going to show her. Like I knew it. I from my experiences with those various people over the years, I know how much something can make a difference. And so I knew I had to figure out my own head. Or I was going to make her grow up with the same insecurities that I had. So that was where the biggest transition came for me. And then, yeah, finally, I was working with Nancy Clark.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, so kind of got the best of the best there.
Yeah, you did.
She thankfully reached out to me and said, you know, I'd love to help you. And she kind of really made the eating side of it, the kind of understanding that I had been refueling, finally getting me to accept that it was my eating that was causing the problem here, and just kind of making me see food differently. Like the thing Nancy says over and over again is be curious. And yeah. I've taken that approach, not just to my eating, but also to other areas of my life. And I can't thank Nancy enough. So, yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, no, Nancy's great. I met her when I was, I think it was when I was in grad school, it was like ages ago. She was speaking at, I think it was like a triathlon expo or conference or something. And I was like manning a stand for some place I was volunteering for. But it, I just remember it was like at the height of like as keto was popping up and all the stuff. And she was talking about the importance of eating carbs. And like, it was just funny seeing some of the people in the audience react to that. But so true.
I just want to add one thing about her.
Yes.
She, one thing that kind of sums up her approach is I remember saying to her at one point, like, you know, when she made me kind of change the volume of where my calories were coming from. So they were coming like earlier in the day. She made me do the like buckets thing where you eat bucket a certain amount within a 4-hour window. And then, you know, I'd say to her like, Nancy, I'm getting to the evening and I can't eat my sweets. Like I love my sweets, but like, I'm not hungry anymore. And firstly, like seeing that as a negative is kind of comical.
But yeah.
Secondly, I was like, but what do I do about my sweets? And she's like, then eat it for your one of your daytime buckets. And I was like, so what? Like, have ice cream at 2 p.m.? And she was like, exactly. Get your 600 calories of ice cream if that's what you want and have it at 2 p.m. And I was just like, my mind was just like, because, you know, I was like, oh, I'd never thought about having like sweets earlier in the day, you know, like a big thing. So it just, she just kind of flipped everything. So,
Yeah. And that's a big one. And I work with that in my clients all the time. It's like identifying what those food rules are, whether you're subconscious of them or not. And yeah, you don't have to, you can have ice cream on a Monday afternoon if that's what you want. You know, it doesn't have to be Friday evening or Saturday evening or whatever it is, the end of the day, which most of the time people are so scared to have a sweet early in the week or early in the day because who knows what's around the corner later and then I might eat both. You know, that's usually like the fear, right?
Yep.
But absolutely. That's a really big one. What advice do you have? Any other kind of piece of advice for younger runners, female or male, really? Because I know Amenorrhea obviously specifically to women, but men are just as susceptible to kind of disordered eating and the effects of that. Trying, you know, just any piece of advice for people trying to avoid some of the struggles that you had.
I mean, there's so many things I could say, but I think the biggest thing is, what Nancy taught me, there are no bad foods. If you love fried chicken and chips, fried chicken and fries, if that's your thing that you love, have it. And just because you have it doesn't mean that you're going to, like, I think a fear is that if you let yourself have those things, if you let yourself eat more, you're not going to be able to stop. And I was so worried. I kept saying to Nancy, like, what if I can't stop eating? And then I end up like obese and I I'm out of control. And she, you know, said, you never get there and you don't, like, your body reaches a point when it's had enough and it feels safe. My hunger just vanished, not vanished as in I wasn't hungry ever, but the like kind of constant itch to eat suddenly disappeared. So it, it will calm down when you finally reached a point. And so many women reach out to me when they're just at the edge of like giving up. They're like, I've tried so hard. I've gained this weight. I've eaten more. I've done all this. And they're right on the edge. They're so close. But the biggest thing is you have to let go of, I just need to get to 120 pounds and then it will happen. Mm-hmm. If I can get to this amount of calories a day, then it will happen. But the biggest thing from all the thousands of women I've heard from and seen, it's when you finally let go and say, F it, whatever it takes, I'm doing it. When you finally reach that point where you're like, I don't care. Like, I'm doing this. I'm committed. I'll do what it takes. And you kind of free your mind of that, like, chain of like, I've just got to get here, or I only have to do this, then it finally clicks into place. So I'd say that's the thing above all else. And then also, unfortunately, you can work with a dietitian, but a lot of cases, the food is just a representation of something else. So if you address your eating, but you don't address the insecurity or the whatever is going on internally, it's going to manifest some other way. Absolutely. So you have to work with either a therapist, a psychologist, a counselor, someone. And I know it's expensive. Trust me. Like, yes. I hated handing over $150 to see a therapist once a week, but it's going to keep finding other ways if you don't sort it out.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. No, thank you for that. I couldn't agree more. I know we're on a clock, so I have a few more questions for you and I'll let you go. The Running for Real community, obviously you have this amazing podcast with over 2.5 million downloads, and it started out as a blog. Is that right? Back when you were running, or did it always start as a podcast? Like what inspired you to kind of create this community that you created?
Well, my original blog name in like 2012, maybe even 2010, was Insatiable Sweet Tooth. How was that? So it originally was my website where I would put my creations, if you want to call them that, of like, I know, I'll make a chocolate chip cookie into an Oreo chocolate chip cookie with pieces of frosting and sprinkles and brownies and la 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 la. Like, I thought I was being like cool, but really it was just my body be like, give me some calories. But then, the podcast, the community, Running for Real, I actually founded when I was going through my transition, which may again be part of why I was able to handle it. Somehow focusing on others, creating this place for others, gave me some kind of purpose that allowed me to get through it. And maybe that's why I handled it so easily. But yeah, founded Running Through in 2017. It was, a podcast straight away. I had plenty of blog articles by that point for runners. I decided to make it into a community, a place where people could go, where everything is on social media is very much like what you can, you're like inspired by people, but I wanted a place where people could say, hey, today sucked. And, I really struggled today. And other people could say, hey, me too. Or like, oh, I went through that last week, but trust me, it's so worth it to stick with it. So I wanted a place for people to feel like they are not alone. That was kind of what it was created for. And it's just grown from there. And I have a wonderful Facebook community called Superstars and all the other stuff that goes along with it.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I love your podcast as well. I've been listening. I just listened recently to the one with Kara Goucher and Lauren Fleshman. And I mean, there are just so many great ones on there. And you actually have a whole nutrition series with actually some of the people, Heather Kaplan, like she's been on my show and some other nutrition experts. But yeah, tell us a bit about that series.
I actually, to be honest, I've kind of been pushing people away from that because
sorry about that.
Yeah, okay. No, you're fine. I found that people got really frustrated because when it comes to nutrition, people want an answer. And the whole point of that series was to show people that there is no answer.
Well, but I found that this podcast.
But I found that people are blaming me, saying, I don't feel any more confident than I did before. And so I actually kind of, I'm not encouraging that as much because I just feel like I know how frustrating it is to hear people say, there is no best diet, there is no best way of eating. You have to, know what's best for you. But unfortunately, that's the answer. So
it's absolutely answer. Yeah. And that's why you get individualized advice. And if you're able to see a dietitian, work with someone and figure that out or try it on yourself or whatever. Yeah. I mean, there's no sexy answer here or like amazing black and white answer. It's exactly.
Yeah. And that's what people wanted from a nutrition series was an answer. But I'd say go to listen to the Jennifer Gaudiani and the Nancy Clark podcast episodes on the main feed. Those are my two. And Renee McGregor as well. Those three are the three big ones, I'd say.
Yeah. So you're, of course, pregnant now and you have a 2-year-old daughter. Let's talk nutrition and family life just briefly. Like how has becoming a mom kind of changed your nutrition? You already spoke about, you know, how you view yourself and making sure that you're being careful about how you speak in front of your daughter and all of that. Any other kind of thoughts? I mean, you don't know the gender of your next child, of course. It'll be interesting if it's a boy. I mean, I guess it doesn't really matter. But any other thoughts on kind of family life and, you know, you now have a toddler who eats with you and all that kind of stuff. Has that kind of changed anything for you guys at all?
Yeah. I mean, we did what is very common in England called baby-led weaning. I don't know what the term is over here, where you don't give them any purees or packets or anything. It's you give them a floret of broccoli or like some carrots and the whole point is by the time they get to maybe a year, they're basically eating what you're eating. So every night we have dinner together every night. I really feel that's so important. The three of us, she for the most part eats what we eat. You know, sometimes she is a toddler, there's some things that are like sauces that toddlers don't like sauces. And so she might have like a plain version, like the same ingredients, just without the sauce. But we really believe that's important to have a dinner together. So she sees us eating a meal together. She loves it. She eats cheese very well. Like she loves chickpeas. They're probably her favorite food. and she does eat very healthy, good foods. But we have also, and we have this approach that we don't give her a dessert every evening. She eats her dinner, that's it. There's no, you get fruit after dinner. It's just, that's it. But then if we're going to go for ice cream, Steve and I, we let her have pretty much as she wants. Like if, you know, she's like, I want some, like constantly, you know, wanting more, but we let her, while we're eating our ice cream, we let her have, obviously that makes us speed up our own ice cream eating because the cookies get great because she's done. We let her have as many scoopfuls as she can get while we're eating ours. So we don't like restrict in any way and say, no, you're not allowed this. But we also try and, for me, having dessert when kids have fruit after dinner, I just feel like that was kind of setting, that's what sets people up, like for me to feel like a need for a dessert every day. So I really was against that. But for the most part, we just kind of try and keep it casual. I think so far she's eating well and, she enjoys to eat. Just trying to watch what I say around her.
Yeah. You've spoken before about wanting to potentially return to professional running, potentially. I know baby two is coming, so maybe that's hard to kind of think about right now since that's the main thing on the horizon for you. But do you think that's something that you still may want to do? I mean, you did just win the half marathon in Disney not that long ago, so that was, I'm sure, fun. but yeah, any thoughts on that?
I think right now I'm leaning towards no. But I think that's because I can't see right now in my head, I can't see a clear picture of how it would work without me getting into some of the negative things that I did before. Not so much the eating. I'm not worried about that part. I really feel like I've kind of got a handle on things and I understand that. And I've done a lot of growth that I don't care what people think of me and how I look anymore. But I think it would more be if I can find a way of finding joy in the challenge, finding joy, kind of more of like the Buddhist Zen approach to running. If I could find that kind of like, I want to find joy in the running. And if it goes well, great. If I keep getting better, great. But I don't want any, I won't handle well this. I'm going to qualify for the 2024 Olympic team. That is my goal. I'm setting it out 4 years now. I don't respond to that. I don't think that's healthy for me. So it's just kind of be almost like an accident thing if it does happen.
Yeah, and of course, like with the Disney thing, that was a super fun race. You were, you know, big smile on your face. I think you're wearing like a tutu or something. Like,
yeah,
clearly you're having fun there. All right, real fast. I'm going to just do my quick bites questions, or maybe we won't do all of them since I know you have to go. Favorite meal or snack when in a hurry?
This is really it. Well, they're going to love that I said this. This is what came to my mind. Generation UCan peanut butter bars, peanut butter chocolate bars.
Is that what you use for your like race and training fueling? UCan?
I use UCan, yeah. Big UCan fan. Yeah.
Awesome. Favorite meal or snack when you're not in a hurry?
See, right now I'm in a weird place. I'm really not that into eating right now.
I just, tough.
Nothing sounds really good. But tacos have been my thing this pregnancy. So tacos.
Most bizarre or exotic food that you've ever tried?
Shark, I guess.
Oh, okay. Did you like it?
Yeah, kind of. It's very like kind of almost like chickeny. It's very like dense. Yeah.
Okay. How do you like your eggs cooked?
I'm not really an eggs fan. My mum hated eggs growing up. She was allergic to them, so it kind of rubbed off on me. But I will eat scrambled eggs, but I wouldn't ever choose them. I'd always pick like something else.
Okay. I know you're pregnant, but wine, beer, or liquor? And actually, when I was pregnant with babe number two, I definitely had some wine on a regular.
I'm going to say cider. I'm going to choose
cider. Ooh, I love cider.
I'm a cider girl.
None of the best. Yeah. Yep. Awesome. What foods remind you of growing up?
Toad, what we call toad in the hole in England, or a roast dinner.
Okay. Well, toad in the hole is an egg though, right?
Toad in the hole is like kind of pancake batter, but it puffs up around sausages.
Oh, sausage. Okay. I always think of like a fried egg and a toast. What's your favorite ice cream flavor?
Cake batter. Although it's starting to change now. I really think the cake batter was, again, a lot of that like obsessive sugar thing. I mean, again, in pregnancy, I'm into like vanilla or mint choc chip, like more plain things.
And last but not least, top three items of gear that are most essential to your active lifestyle.
Well, I'll say generation UCan again. Items of gear. I'm not really a big like gadgets kind of person. So I'd say my ultra running shoes a hat. I always wear a hat when I'm running.
What kind of hat do you usually wear? Any particular brands?
I guess right now it's John G, but yeah, not really specific. Nice.
Okay, awesome. Well, thank you so much, Tina, for coming on. I really appreciate your time and wishing you the best of luck with baby number two.
Thank you so much, Claire.
Thanks. All right, have a good one. Bye.
And that wraps up my discussion with Tina. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did. You can find Tina on Instagram as Tina Muir, that's M-U-I-R 88. And her website is tinamuir.com. I highly, highly recommend her podcast, Running for Real. So many incredible guests, and she has over, I guess, 2.5 million downloads. It is awesome. So definitely check that out. And thank you again, Tina, for your time, and wishing you the best of luck with baby number two. I can certainly say from at least my experience, it is awesome. It is hard, but really, really wonderful. As always, if you want to get in touch, shoot me an email, eatforendurance@gmail.com. You can visit my website, eatforendurance.com, and submit your questions or comments through the contact form there. And of course, you can find me on Instagram @eatforendurance. All right, guys, have a good one.